1920, Chicago, a young woman walks into a flight school and asks to learn to fly. They say no, she walks into another one. Same answer. Then another, and another. The reason isn't money, the reason isn't aptitude. The reason is that she's black, and she's a woman. And as far as the American aviation establishment of 1920 is concerned, that ends the conversation. Her name is Bessie Coleman, and what she does next is going to change everything. I'm Tail Dragger. This is The Hangar on Radio Hangar, and today we're going to talk about the most determined pilot who ever earned a license they had no business being able to earn, given everything stacked against them. Pull up a chair, this one's worth the time. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com to understand what Bessie Coleman was up against. You have to understand the world she was living in. She was born on January 26, 1892, in Atlanta, Texas. One of 13 children, her father, George Coleman, was of mixed Cherokee and black heritage. Her mother, Susan, was black. They moved to Waxahachie when Bessie was two, and they worked, not comfortably. They picked cotton. Bessie worked the fields alongside her family as a child, and she also kept the books for the family's picking earnings, because even at a young age, she had a head for numbers that her mother recognized and cultivated. She walked 4 miles each way to a segregated one-room schoolhouse. She loved books with the kind of intensity that makes teachers take notice. When she'd exhausted what Waxahachie had to offer, she saved enough money from washing and ironing other people's clothes to get herself to Langston University in Oklahoma, one of the few institutions of higher learning that would accept her. She made it one semester before the money ran out, so she went north. Around 1915, right in the tide of the Great Migration, she moved to Chicago. Hundreds of thousands of black Americans were making that same journey in those years, leaving the Jim Crow South for the industrial cities of the North, chasing wages and something that at least resembled dignity. Bessie landed on the South Side and went to work as a manicurist at the White Sox barbershop. It was good, steady work. She was quick and skilled, and she had a way with people that made customers come back. The shop was a gathering place for black Chicago's professional class, and Bessie Coleman was in the middle of conversations that mattered. Then her brother John came home from France. John Coleman had served with the American Expeditionary Forces in the First World War. He came back with the mixed-up swagger of a man who'd survived something awful and seen something remarkable on the other side of the ocean. He was needling his sister one day, the way brothers do, comparing America unfavorably to France. "French women fly," he reportedly told her. "You women in America aren't so free after all." I don't think John Coleman understood what he'd just done. His sister took that comment and turned it into the question that would define the rest of her life. She started making inquiries about flight training. She contacted schools around Chicago and the Midwest. She visited some of them in person. Everyone said no. The combination of being black and being a woman was simply not something American aviation schools in 1920 were prepared to deal with. Most people would have stopped there. The wall was total. This wasn't one bad school or one difficult administrator. It was every school. The system was making itself very clear. Bessie Coleman went to Robert Abbott instead. Abbott was the founder and publisher of the Chicago Defender, which was one of the most powerful and widely read black newspapers in the country. The Defender was so influential that it was actually smuggled into the Deep South on Pullman railroad cars, because white authorities in some places considered it dangerous to let people read it. Abbott was a power in black Chicago, and he saw something in Bessie Coleman worth backing. His advice was direct. If American schools won't have you, go somewhere they will. Go to France. So Bessie Coleman did something that seems almost impossible when you really sit with it. She decided she was going to move to France to earn a pilot's license that America wouldn't give her. And she started learning French to make it happen. She studied the language alongside her day job. She took tutoring. She saved money. Abbott helped connect her with resources and support. She prepared herself the way a pilot prepares for a flight into weather, methodically with full knowledge of the risk. She sailed from New York in November of 1920, bound for France. She enrolled at the École d'Aviation des Frères Caudron at Le Croteuil. That's a small coastal town on the Somme estuary in the north of France. And if you know your World War I geography, you know what the Somme means. The ground around there had been soaked in blood just a few years before. The school used Nieuport biplanes, and those were not gentle training aircraft. The Nieuport family had produced some of France's premier fighter aircraft during the war. Fast, sensitive, demanding airplanes that did not suffer inattentive hands on the controls. She trained in French, in an aircraft type she'd never touched before, in a country where she knew almost no one, through a northern French winter that was cold and gray and unforgiving. She did it anyway. On June 15, 1921, Bessie Coleman earned her international pilot's license from the Fédération Aéronautique Internationale, the international governing body for aviation records and certification. She was the first Black woman in the world to hold an internationally recognized pilot's license. She was also, through her father's Cherokee heritage, the first woman of Native American descent in the United States to earn one. She was 29 years old. She had done the impossible thing. She still wasn't satisfied. She went back to Europe in 1922. Germany, the Netherlands. She wanted aerobatics training, and she found pilots and schools willing to teach her. She understood the economics clearly. In 1920s America, aviation was spectacle. The barnstorming era was at full roar. Crowds packed county fairgrounds and farm fields from California to Virginia to watch pilots do things in the sky that defied common sense. Loops, rolls, vertical dives that bottomed out 50 feet above the crowd. Wing walking, parachute drops. The barnstormers of the early 1920s were the most electrifying public entertainers in the country. And the airplane was still new enough that seeing one up close could make a grown man feel like a child again. Bessie Coleman was going to join that world on her own terms. She came home with a plan. Her billing was Brave Bessie. She had a uniform made to her specifications, a military-style cut that gave her authority the moment she walked onto a flight line. She had the bearing of someone who knew exactly what she was doing, and crowds sensed it before she ever climbed into a cockpit. Her first major American exhibition was in September of 1922, at Curtis Field in Garden City, New York, organized to benefit a Black charitable organization and attended by thousands. She flew well. She drew attention from the Black press across the country. She was exactly what she had set out to become. She toured. She performed, she gave lectures in churches and schools and community halls, talking about aviation, talking about what was possible, encouraging young Black men and women to look at the sky and see possibility rather than a ceiling. She was not just a performer, she was building something, and she had the line she would not cross. Promoters in the South, and some outside it, wanted her at events where the Black audience used a separate entrance and sat in a segregated section. She refused, every single time. She would walk away from the booking, turn down the money, cancel the appearance rather than lend her presence to an arrangement that told her own people they were lesser. In 1920s America, that was not a small thing. That took something beyond stubbornness. In 1923, she was performing in California when her engine failed at about 300 feet. The airplane hit the ground hard. She came out of it with a broken leg and three broken ribs. A lot of people having crashed an airplane at 300 feet and broken four bones would have reconsidered the career. Bessie Coleman spent more than a year recovering. Then she went right back to flying. She toured Texas in 1925, and the reception was something remarkable. Waxahachie, her hometown, turned out to see her. Here was the girl who used to walk 4 miles to a one-room schoolhouse, who'd spent one semester at Langston and had to come home when the money gave out, who'd spent her mornings doing other people's laundry. She came home in an airplane and did loops over the people who had known her as a child. I don't have words adequate to what that must have looked like from the ground. Through all of it, she kept her eye on the thing that mattered most. Bessie Coleman wanted to open a flight school for Black Americans. She wanted to be for others what no one had been willing to be for her. She was performing and saving and talking to investors and donors, and the school was getting closer. The plan was real. The money was coming together. April 30, 1926. Jacksonville, Florida. She was scheduled to perform the next day at Paxson Field for a charity event. The afternoon before, she went up in a Curtis Jenny to scout the field. The Jenny, the JN-4 biplane they'd been flying since the First World War, was the workhorse of the barnstorming era. Cheap, available everywhere, her mechanic and publicist, a man named William Wills, was at the controls in the front cockpit. Bessie was in the rear seat, not flying, leaning over the side to look at the terrain below, marking out where she'd run her routines. The next morning. She wasn't wearing a seatbelt, at a couple of thousand feet on a survey flight, with someone else at the controls, a lot of pilots wouldn't have been. At about 2,000 feet, the Jenny pitched suddenly into a steep dive. Then it went into a spin. The airplane was not recoverable. Bessie Coleman was thrown clear of the aircraft. She fell 2,000 feet to the ground. William Wills lost control and went in with the airplane. Both of them died. Investigators found the cause afterward. A wrench had come loose inside the airplane and jammed the control linkage, a piece of maintenance equipment that should never have been free in the cockpit. The controls locked. There was nothing anyone could have done. She was 34 years old. The flight school was still a plan on paper. Chicago went quiet. Thousands of people viewed her body as she lay in state. Ida B. Wells, the great journalist and civil rights activist, delivered remarks at her funeral. The Black press across the country ran her story for weeks. She had given so much, and the thing she'd been building was still unfinished. But here's what I keep coming back to when I think about Bessie Coleman. She had already done the most important work. She had shown that the door wasn't locked from the inside. She had shown that the sky, whatever the earth said about it, was reachable by anyone willing to go far enough to reach it. She'd done it by learning a foreign language, crossing an ocean, earning a license in a foreign country and a foreign aircraft type, and then coming home and flying and refusing to fly at the events that would have diminished her people, and standing in front of thousands of young black men and women and telling them through her very presence that this was possible. The Bessie Coleman Aero Clubs formed in her wake, and in 1941, the United States Army began training black military aviators at Tuskegee Institute in Alabama. The Tuskegee Airmen, the Red Tails, they flew P-51 Mustangs as escort fighters over Nazi Germany, and they built a combat record that dismantled every argument ever made about whether black pilots belonged in the sky. 5 squadrons, more than 400 combat pilots, more than 15,000 missions. They stood on the ground. Bessie Coleman had staked out 20 years before. In 1995, the United States Postal Service put her face on a stamp, about 70 years late. But there she is. Every year, black pilots fly over Lincoln Cemetery in Chicago on the anniversary of her death. They drop flowers on her grave from the air.
Now here's where it gets interesting to me. If you step back far enough, every barrier Bessie Coleman faced was external. The wall was not her. The wall was the world around her, telling her through every available mechanism that the sky was not for her. And she made a calculation that most people never get to. The calculation that the problem isn't you, the problem is the world. And the world can sometimes be made to move if you're willing to go far enough. She went to France. She learned French. She earned the license. She came home. The world moved. Most of what you heard today comes from the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum, the National Aviation Hall of Fame, and the published history of the Bessie Coleman Foundation. More at RadioHanger.com. I'm Taildragger. See you next time.